you're listening to a special podcast of human rights activist Peter Tatchell speaking to the Central London Humanist Group. The event took place on August 22nd, 2012, and his talk was titled Human Rights versus Human Wrongs. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical, rationalist, humanist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But now, here's Peter Tatchell's talk.
Thank you very, very much, and by way of explanation, the reason I'm a bit late is I was flying back from Berlin today, and the plane was nearly 2 hours late. And then compounding it, the train to Liverpool Street was another 25 minutes late. So, sincere apologies. I was there, but incidentally, meeting up, having a reunion with former dissidents from the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, who I worked with in the 1970s and 80s. In fact, I went there twice to have secret meetings with those activists in East Germany in 1973 and again in 1986 to help publicise their struggle for freedom and to mobilise support in this country and other countries around Europe to support their struggle. And particularly those in the early 70s were incredibly brave and heroic because they were a very, very tiny minority with very little public support in those days because people just accepted things the way they were. The second generation in the 80s had more public support and eventually, of course, led to the fall of the wall. But it was great to be reunited with these very, very inspiring, brave, heroic East German activists. Anyway, the theme of my talk tonight is about human rights law. And the big problem is that, of course, we have in this country and internationally a vast body of human rights law. You know, going back to 1948 and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Genocide Convention, the Geneva Conventions, subsequently the Convention Against Torture, there's this vast range of human rights law that exists and has been collectively agreed by the nations of the world. And it covers everything from the denial of the right to self-determination to the rights of women, anti-racism, the prohibition on torture, war crimes, crimes against humanity. The huge problem we face is to get these laws enforced. They exist, and everybody says they're there and they've signed up to them, but so many countries violate them, and even of those countries that don't violate them, so often there's a sense of powerlessness that these laws are not being enforced. As you will probably remember, in 1999 and again in 2001, I tried to use the powers of citizen's arrest to get President Mugabe put on trial on charges of torture. And, you know, in both instances, in 1999 in London and in 2001 in Brussels, I had all the legal evidence required under British and Belgian law and under the United Nations Convention Against Torture to have Mugabe arrested, because both Britain and Belgium had signed the United Nations Convention and incorporated it into their domestic laws. And that legislation provided for the arrest of anyone who either committed or condoned, acquiesced, or colluded with acts of torture anywhere in the world. So it had an absolutely universal jurisdiction. And under that legislation, the British government or the Belgian government could have very easily arrested President Mugabe when he came respectively to Britain or to Belgium. But they didn't. So that failing prompted me to try and arrest him. Now, I'll just briefly tell you one of the stories about that attempt. The first one in 1999 was, I'd been organising at the request of Zimbabwean human rights activists I've been organising protests in London to try and highlight the human rights abuses that were happening, which at that stage were barely ever reported in the Western media, and very few human rights organisations were campaigning or publicising those abuses. Now, I organised protests outside the Zimbabwe High Commission in the Strand, and various other protests, lobbying of MPs, lobbying of members of the House of Lords. But I've got to be honest that those protests made very little impact. Very little impact. So I thought, well, what can I do to up the ante? What can I do to sort of help, you know, perhaps be a bit provocative and confrontational to get this issue in the news and in the public consciousness? Because that, of course, is the precondition for change. You know, unless people know what's going on, there's going to be no momentum to challenge the regime. So I hit on the idea of using the powers of citizens' arrest. Now, all of us as private citizens have the power to arrest someone if we have strong evidence that they have committed a crime or are about to commit a crime. So if you've got that evidence, you have the right to make a citizen's arrest. This is an ancient right that goes back centuries, and it still exists in British law and the law of many, many other countries around the world. And I decided to focus on the crime of torture, particularly because it had been incorporated specifically into British domestic law under Section 134 of the Criminal Justice Act 1988, and because it had a universal jurisdiction. So any high government official who has committed or colluded or acquiesced in acts of torture anywhere can be arrested in any signatory ratifying nation. So this universal jurisdiction gave real power and effect to the seriousness and the legal appropriateness and validity of an attempt to have Mugabe arrested. So I thought of this idea, and then of course the big problem was when and how to try and execute it. But within 6 months, the problem was solved, because late on Thursday night, towards the end of October 1999, I got a call at about midnight from a guy who seemed to have a very strong African accent. He said, "You may be interested to know that President Mugabe has arrived in Britain on a shopping visit. He's here to go Christmas shopping at Harrods. He's staying at the St. James's Court Hotel in Buckingham Gate. And he's flying back to Zimbabwe on Saturday night at 6 p.m. from Heathrow Airport." Before I could ask any questions, the caller hung up. And of course, I thought to myself, is this a hoax or is it for real? So I decided to gamble that it was a genuine tip-off. And so I, next morning, phoned around various people asking if they might be willing to help me try and get Mugabe arrested. I've got to tell you, there were very few takers. Most people had reasonable excuses, like they had a job, they had a work to go to. But there were quite a few people who thought, well, this is surely going to end up with arrest, if not, a beating by Mugabe's bodyguards. But eventually, the only people who were willing were members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender human rights group Outrage, which I was involved in. They were the only people who were up for it. And of those, only three others volunteered. So it was me and three others. So once I got their agreement, we decided to try the arrest on Saturday morning, early in the morning, assuming that he would at some point leave the hotel to go Christmas shopping at Harrods and then go to the Heathrow Airport to get his flight. So after agreeing all that, I zipped off to Amnesty International headquarters and got the dossier on the torture of two black journalists, Ray Choto and Mark Chavanduka, who worked for the Standard newspaper in Harare, and who had just a few months earlier had been subjected to gross, really grotesque torture by Mugabe's henchmen, and where Mugabe was on public record as saying they got what they deserved. He was on record as effectively endorsing the torture. So the legal case against Mugabe was incredibly strong. Incredibly strong. Armed with these affidavits and all this evidence from Amnesty International, the four of us assembled at 8:30 in the morning at the booking hall at St. James's Park Tube Station, just around the corner from the hotel. I arranged to have a journalist, a photographer, and a video person to accompany us, because obviously we wanted to get all this captured and documented by independent journalists, because the main purpose of this protest was, firstly, to publicise the human rights abuses, and then second, hopefully, but with some degree of doubt, to actually try and get him arrested and put on trial. So anyway, we turned up at 8:30 in the morning, and then it was freezing cold, by the way, freezing cold. I hadn't eaten breakfast, I was shivering, and you know, it was not a pleasant day. We tried looking conspicuous. One of the guys went into a telephone box and pretended to make phone calls. Another guy stood at a newspaper, stood by a bus stop reading a newspaper. I sort of lurked behind sort of columns out of sight, fearing that I might be recognised. And of course, just to make things particularly bad for us, time ticked away and there was no Mugabe. So after about 2 hours, and you're getting close to about 10:30, it was really difficult to be inconspicuous. And you know, the concierge from the hotel, the guy with the top hat and tails who, you know, stands out the front to greet new guests, I noticed that he started looking in our direction. And we were obviously trying to be inconspicuous, but it's, you know, after 2 hours, it's not exactly easy, you know. And so I started to get quite worried that we might be rumbled, or we might have aroused suspicion, and the police might be called, and the whole thing would fall to pieces. My anxieties were compounded when, a few minutes later, from the side entrance, emerged 5 or 6 African-looking guys who started looking and pointing in our direction. And I reasoned, or calculated, or guessed, speculated, that these possibly were Mugabe's security people. And I thought, well, if they're suspicious, if they think there is any potential threat from us, first of all, they're bound to call the police. And once the police arrive, you know, the whole plan will fall to pieces. So I thought, I've got to do something. What? Now, in those circumstances, when you're freezing cold, you haven't eaten much, you're incredibly nervous. Nervous about, you know, making the operation, the action succeed. Nervous about the possible consequences of arrest or a beating. You know, it's very, very nerve-wracking. And in all these situations, you know, despite all my years of experience in doing these kinds of things, I get splitting headaches, my stomach is turning over, I'm shaking and shivering, and it's very, very difficult to think clearly and think on your feet. But fortunately for me, suddenly I had a brainwave, and so I strolled across the street, beaming and smiling, and walked straight up to these African guys, and said, "Hi guys, I'm from the News of the World, and these are my photographers. We know that Elton John is in this hotel with his new boyfriend. We've got to get the story and the pictures for tomorrow's paper." And they looked at me like... I said, "I'll give you £50 if you tell us which room he's in." I think I actually had about £10 in my pocket. But "I'll give you £50. And they still were looking and shaking their heads, and they were talking in, I don't know, Shona or Nebadili. I don't know what they were saying. I said, "I'll give you £75. I said, "My editor's going to kill us if we don't get back with this story. We've got to get the story and photographs. Please, please, please tell us." And still they were shaking their heads, and I was still very anxious about how they were responding. So suddenly I just picked on one of them and said, "I know you. You can't deny it. You are one of Elton John's security guards. I saw you at the Wembley concert 2 months ago. You can't deny it. I know you work for Elton John. He's got to be in this hotel, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Now, come on, tell us. I'll give you 100 quid. And then he started obviously translating what I was saying, and they all burst out laughing. Then they walked away. And I turned and I thought, I think I might have convinced them. And sure enough, about 10 or 15 minutes later, out came President Mugabe in his limousine. I scratched the top of my head to signal that he was in the car, and my colleagues further up the street ran out straight in front of this speeding limousine. An incredibly brave, heroic thing to do. It screeched to a halt, literally about 6 inches from their legs. Then one of them ran behind the car and stood there, so the car couldn't go forward and couldn't go backward. I ran from the side and opened the rear car door. Amazingly, it was unlocked. And there in the seat, straight before me, was President Robert Mugabe. With this hand, I reached in and gently took him by the arm, and then held out this hand to show I didn't have a weapon, and then calmly said, "President Mugabe, you are under arrest on charges of torture. Torture is a crime under international law. I am now summoning the police." You should have seen the look on his face. His eyes popped and his jaw dropped. He held up his hands, he shrunk back in his seat like this. He looked like a frightened 10-year-old child. I suspect he may have even thought that he was going to be killed. To which I thought, now you know what your victims feel like, except we aren't going to kill you, we're going to take you to a court of law where you will have a chance to be defended by a lawyer, and there'll be a fair trial. Which, of course, he never gives his own victims. Anyway, the other thing that was very noticeable was the fact that he is very, very dark-skinned, but you could see a visible ashen pallor across his face. Next to him in the other seat was, I don't know who it was, a bodyguard, an assistant. He just squeezed up in the corner like this, you know. Useless, hopeless. Then my colleagues, while this was happening, my colleagues then phoned the police. And very quickly, 3 police officers arrived on the scene. We explained who we were, what we were doing. We showed them the legal papers. They just knocked them out of our hands and then proceeded to arrest us. They're in trouble, of course. There were 3 of them and 4 of us. So it took 2 officers to drag one of us away. And as soon as they put one of us on the pavement and went back to get someone else, the person on the pavement went back and lay under the car or sat in front of the car. And eventually we got more and more daring. And eventually one of the guys climbed right under the car. I mean, for heaven's sake. Well, again, incredibly brave, because they could have decided just to drive off and he would have been run over. And, you know, very seriously injured, if not killed. So we played this cat and mouse game for about 10 minutes until police reinforcements arrived. In the end, I think about 20 or 30 officers arrived, and we were very, very violently manhandled and arrested by the police. We were taken to Belgravia police station and held in the cells for nearly 6.5 hours, during which time the police refused to discuss anything about the legal case, which we explained we had, against Mugabe. What they were more interested in is what charges they could throw at us. And they were talking about criminal damage, assaulting a police officer, behaviour likely to cause a breach of the peace, riot and affray, which is a very serious offence. They were going to throw the book at us. Meanwhile, of course, President Mugabe was given a police escort to go Christmas shopping at Harrods. In the end, on the opening day of our trial, suddenly and unexpectedly, the prosecution withdrew all evidence to the fury of the magistrate. Now, I don't know why that decision was taken. I can only speculate. But my surmise is that they did not want it tested in a court of law that we had acted lawfully, because a jury might have found in our favour, and that would have established a precedent. it would have encouraged perhaps more people to try citizens' arrests and more pressure for the government to take action against tyrants and torturers who come to this country. The upshot, of course, was we didn't succeed, but we did generate massive worldwide publicity about the attempt and the reasons why we did that attempt, the torture, not just of those two journalists, but of many other Zimbabwean citizens, and the crackdown on all dissent in the country. What shocks me is that I presume, I can't prove, but I presume the decision to allow President Mugabe to return to Zimbabwe must have been taken at the very highest level. I'm assuming with the connivance of the then Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Paul Condon, with the then Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, and with the then Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith. And if it's true that they did actually connive and agree and sanction his return, then they have blood on their hands. Because this is before most of the murder and mayhem really began. There was repression at this time, shocking repression, but nothing on the scale of what followed 2 or 3 years later. And they could have potentially stopped that, because if he had been arrested and put on trial, if the leadership of the government, the leader, Robert Mugabe, had been removed from the scene and put on trial in The Hague or in Britain or wherever, perhaps the history of Zimbabwe might have been somewhat different. I'm not saying it would have been better, but I suspect probably not as draconian as it turned out. Because from all the evidence, he has consistently been the driving force for the wave of repression. He's been the one who has sanctioned it, colluded with it, endorsed it, encouraged it. So that's the tale of the first citizen's arrest. I won't bore you with the second one, but the second one was even worse because it ended up being beaten unconscious by his bodyguards. But, you know, in both instances, I was acting lawfully based on international human rights law. Some of you may know that some years afterwards, I applied at Bow Street's Magistrate Court for an international arrest warrant for President Mugabe. So I actually went through the processes of applying to a British court for an international arrest warrant, as opposed to me doing a citizen's arrest. And to my surprise, I was given, I think, 2 or 3 days in court to make the case. The magistrate, at the end of the day, in delivering his judgment, did not dispute one iota of the evidence. In fact, he had admitted there was compelling evidence that President Mugabe was implicated in human rights abuses contrary to international law. But he said that, nevertheless, under British law, under the State Immunity Act 1978, President Mugabe, as a head of state, has absolute immunity from power. Absolute immunity in power, absolute immunity from prosecution. To which my response to the magistrate is, or was, what's the point of having international human rights laws if the key perpetrators are exempt from prosecution? If they cannot be held accountable, what's the point of having these laws? And the magistrate said, well, this is a matter for Parliament and for politicians and the government to decide. So it was a very unsatisfactory conclusion. And that indeed is the nub of the problem. You know, countries keep on saying time and time again that under diplomatic conventions, heads of state and other high government officials are immune from prosecution. They are exempt from these laws. Now, in that case, I'd actually argued against that from a legal point of view. I'd argued that at the time of the Nuremberg judgments in 1946, it was specifically held that high state officials were not immune from prosecution when it came to war crimes and crimes against humanity, such as torture. That was the judgment of Nuremberg, that the Nazi leaders could not use their high office to hide behind diplomatic convention that senior state officials should have immunity. That was agreed in 1946 and has since subsequently been reiterated in a number of judgments. You will know, for example, that in the case of Slobodan Milosevic, the ex-leader of Yugoslavia, he was indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity while he was still the president of Yugoslavia. It was ruled that even though he was a head of state, these crimes were so grave, so severe, that he should not be exempt from prosecution. The same logic applied in the case of Charles Taylor of Liberia, who's not long ago been sentenced for the crimes which happened under his watch. He was also indicted while president of Liberia. So there are precedents in international jurisprudence for heads of state and high government officials to be prosecuted. So I would argue that this principle that state immunity applies to these high officials has been eroded. It also, of course, is very explicitly mentioned in Article 27 of the Rome Treaty, which established the International Criminal Court. Article 27 very explicitly states that high government officials, including heads of state, do not have immunity from prosecution for war crimes and crimes against humanity. So the precedents are there, and of course the question is, why aren't they being applied? You know, here we have now this horrendous barbarity in Syria, and yet the International Criminal Court has not issued any international arrest warrants for President Assad and his key henchmen. Now, of course, the International Criminal Court is constrained by various particularities and, you know, various qualifications about its powers, but I would have thought that it is quite possible to interpret the statutes of the Rome Treaty to empower the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant for President Assad and other high officials. And I am very curious, shocked, and dismayed that there's been no attempt to do so, nor that any country, whether it be India or Britain, has ever sought to try and press the International Court, appeal to the International Court, to issue an arrest warrant for President Assad. Because quite clearly what he is doing and his regime is doing stands in clear contravention of international humanitarian law. I should also add that shortly after the Mugabe case, or around the same time, I also applied for an international arrest warrant for Henry Kissinger, the former US Secretary of State, over the mass indiscriminate bombing of Cambodia in the early 1970s. He was responsible for overseeing the mass carpet bombing of Cambodia, including bombings in known areas of civilian populations, which is a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. And I had evidence from two National Security Agency officials who'd been involved in those programs, who said that Henry Kissinger had taken personal charge and was directly overseeing those bombing operations, which killed and wounded hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians, which is quite clearly a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. So I went to Bow Street Magistrates Court, my favourite court in London, the place where Oscar Wilde, of course, was untried. I went there and applied for an international arrest warrant for Henry Kissinger. Again, to my surprise, I was given 2 or 3 days. And the magistrate listened and, you know, took notes and heard the evidence. And again, as in the Mugabe case, he didn't dispute the basic facts they put before him. What he did question was whether I had the capacity to bring to Britain the witnesses required to corroborate the claims. So that there were two key officials of the former officials of the National Security Agency who were the key witnesses who had implicated Henry Kissinger. And the magistrate said, I'm not convinced that you have the capacity to ensure that they appear at this court. So at this stage, I'm not minded to give you an arrest warrant for Henry Kissinger. And then he said, in any case, by the way, are you seriously suggesting that I should issue a warrant whereby the former United States Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, should be arrested and remanded in Pentonville Prison? Have you been to Pentonville Prison, Mr. Thatcher? Is this a fit place for a former US Secretary of State?
Yes.
I was very tempted to say yes, but I was a bit smarter. I said, well, that's a very good point, Your Honour. I understand that Henry Kissinger is very fond of Oxfordshire. And it just happens that I have a list of estate agents with very desirable properties in Oxfordshire, which would be very much to Henry Kissinger's liking. And I would suggest that he could be placed under house arrest at a property of his choosing and convenience. The magistrate was very amused. But in the end, the ruling was that, you know, he didn't think I had the capacity to bring the witnesses to London. But this sort of implied, if you do get the witnesses and do have this capacity, I might reconsider the case. He sort of left that sort of hanging in the air. So all of these different examples show that the problems we face in getting this vast body of international human rights law enforced, the fact that, you know, you have these diplomatic exemptions which have existed throughout the decades, the fact that they've sometimes been challenged and successfully overturned, in the case of Milosevic and Taylor, but other times upheld. It's interesting that, of course, it's only people like Milosevic and Taylor and a couple of guys from the Congo who've ever fallen foul of these laws, and they're all small fry. But, you know, none of the big ones have ever come into the frame, and there is a credible case. You may disagree with, but there's a credible case to say that the war in Iraq was illegal and that Tony Blair and George Bush could have a credible legal case against them under international humanitarian law. Not just because the war was illegal itself, but of course the conduct of the war in the often indiscriminate attacks upon civilian areas, which is a war crime. So I think, you know, when it comes to international human rights law, there's considerable selectivity about who is targeted, who is eventually prosecuted, and who eventually gets convicted and sentenced. I haven't got an easy answer, but I do think there probably needs to be some perhaps revised United Nations Convention which brings all these statutes within a clear legal framework, which does explicitly state that in all these various cases, torture, war crimes, genocide, and so on, there is or should be no exemption for high state officials. And that needs to be much more explicitly stated. Probably the Rome Treaty needs to be revised to give it more direct powers, because there's all kinds of qualifications and restrictions on its capacity. And, of course, it's notoriously underfunded and understaffed. You know, it's really, really difficult for for the International Criminal Court to keep up with the vast number of cases that could potentially come before it, because there's so little funding and so few staff. So these are things that need to change. And I think, you know, once again, as with the Torture Convention, I think all the other different human rights protections ought to be enforceable by any signatory nation. And some of them you can only do it in, you know, certain jurisdictions. You know, I think there needs to be a universal jurisdiction for all these crimes against humanity and all these different human rights abuses. I mean, there probably needs to be some thought given to some kind of permanent United Nations enforcement agency, maybe even a military force that is charged with, you know, bringing these tyrants and torturers to justice. That's difficult, it's tricky, it's potentially, you know, involves the issues of state sovereignty and, you know, potential abuses in terms of, you know, governments or individuals being selectively targeted, and the whole issue of foreign intervention is a very tricky one. But I think if it was under United Nations auspices, with a United Nations authority under international humanitarian law, rather than, you know, US or British unilateral action, which I oppose, if it was under UN auspices, I think it might be acceptable. How to make that work? Well, that's a difficult one. But certainly in the case of Syria, I have argued in recent months that if there could be an international arrest warrant issued by a body like the International Criminal Court, then I would say there's a strong moral case for some country to send in a snatch squad to seize Assad and his high officials and take them to The Hague. Again, I'm not saying that's easy, but if you look at the history of the Second World War and some of the actions taken by the resistance in occupied Europe and Special Operations Executive and other agents, Nazi leaders were seized, or high Nazi officials were seized and brought under arrest. You know, going into highly militarized, highly protected places, grabbing them, taking them, and successfully bringing them back to face justice. So, again, that's something to think about. Not easy, but something to think about. I think one of the key things, though, is to build a public consciousness and momentum that these laws must be enforced. To build a global movement that we need to not only have these laws written on paper, but they need to be given effect. To act as a deterrent to would-be human rights abuses. Now, I'm not saying that having the both the laws and the methods of enforcement would necessarily stop every dictator and tyrant. But I suspect most of them would think twice. If they thought there was a serious chance of being apprehended and put on trial, I suspect many of them would think twice about the kinds of human rights abuses that they sanctioned. At the moment, because there is no prospect of most of them ever ending up in a court of law, they just ignore this vast array of human rights legislation. They think it's just paper. And for the most part, it is just a written document of good intentions. But if we can make it a reality that actually gets enforced, I think you would see a significant reduction in human rights abuses by many regimes. If they thought they could end up in the dock, I think they would think twice. And I think that to get that process going, we need a global movement across borders, across regions, to ensure that the people's voice is that we believe in human rights and we want these laws enforced. We want these tyrants and torturers brought to justice. Another idea, which I've worked on with some colleagues in the Green Party, is for the idea of a global human rights index as a way of measuring human rights abuses. The idea would be to establish an index of, say, 50 key human rights issues by which each country would be measured, and then each country would be ranked according to their adherence or violation of those human rights issues indexes. The idea would be to establish this index, which would give a snapshot of who really are the human rights abusing countries, and to give an incentive for some countries, not all countries, because some countries will just ignore it, but give an incentive for some countries to try and improve their human rights record. To also, over time, give a snapshot about whether a country is improving its human rights record or going down in terms of increasing human rights violations. The Universal Periodic Review, which has been instituted by the United Nations, which every few years looks at each country and their human rights record, is a step in that direction. This Global Human Rights Index is somewhat more refined and more sophisticated. And the idea was, say, to produce this ranking system. And interestingly, there have been some attempts to set up, you know, smaller or partial versions of this. And it's very interesting that, surprisingly, there are quite a few developing countries that are very high in the index, and quite a few Western countries that are quite low. In fact, the United States is roughly in the middle on a lot of indices. So that might be another way of building momentum for, you know, if you like, a moral momentum, a moral pressure for countries to more strictly observe human rights conventions and laws. As I said, I don't have any easy answers. There are no easy answers. But I think what we all have a duty to do is to do what we can to help encourage our government and all governments to honour the human rights conventions that exist. And our own country is far from exempt. You know, the role of Britain in the use of the anti-terror laws, the role of Britain in extraordinary rendition by the United States. These are all issues that do not sit comfortably with our professed commitment to human rights. Gradually, of course, thanks to campaigns and to legal actions, many of the draconian anti-terror laws have been struck down. When they were first introduced, people could be detained without charge indefinitely, in effect for life. And it took many court actions to eventually have that struck down. For a period, people could have terror suspects, mere suspects, not proven terrorists, could have all their assets frozen or seized without knowing why they were seized, without having any recourse to that. These are things that happen in our country, in our name, and thankfully, as I said, most of them, not all of them, most of them have progressively, eventually been overturned thanks to courageous campaigners and to legal actions. So law has a very important role to play in defending human rights. I'm sure that in the end, eventually, at some point in the future, we will look back on this age and think, how did they sit back and allow these human rights abuses to happen? How did they allow these tyrants and torturers to have the get-out clause that they were high government officials and therefore immune from prosecution? There will come a day in world history when these human rights abuses are not only deemed unacceptable, but they are unacceptable and are enforced. The law will be enforced one day to ensure that those who abuse human rights are brought to justice. And that won't be a day too soon. Thank you.
Now, I'm sure none of you really have to rush off anywhere other than to the pub. So Peter says he's quite happy to stay for questions. It is 8 o'clock. If anyone does have to sort of sneak out, please just sneak out at the back. But we'll stay for another sort of hopefully 20 minutes of questions. Please, my request is please keep them very, very succinct, and please make them questions not statements or lectures on your own part. I have another microphone. The only thing with the microphone is we need to switch this one off briefly to turn that one on. So if you don't have a very loud voice, I'll take the microphone around the room and you can use that. I can see your hands are already... Are these for questions, your hands are up? Or, yeah, OK. That's all I have to say. The only other thing I need to say is Brendan and Laura still got wine at the back of the wine bar. If you'd like another glass of wine, please do. The money is going to Peter's Foundation, so please donate to that. And when you leave, if you could give £2 or more as well to Central and Humanists just to cover the cost of the room and equipment hire as well, that would be absolutely lovely. OK, I'll hand you back to Peter and I'll have a microphone.
OK, so first question.
What can you do now? What?
Well, I mean, in the interim, I mean, there's very many good things you can do. If you're not signed up to Amnesty International's Prisoner of Conscience campaign, support that. Support Amnesty's campaigns and those of other organisations like Human Rights Watch, who are lobbying governments about the enforcement of international human rights law. Write to your MP. Ask your MP to press for, you know, a new British and international legal regime to enforce international human rights law. If you don't know about, there's a very good website called writetothem.com, as in writetothem.com. If you go on that website, it will ask you to put in your postcode, and then it will tell you who your Member of Parliament is and who your 8 MEPs are. And you can email them direct from that website. That's a very good way to lobby. And of course, once you've done the basic standard letter to your MP, then you can copy it and redo it to each of your local MEPs. And we want MEPs to raise this issue in the European Parliament as well, to get European action to enforce international human rights law.
John Snow, the Channel 4 newscaster, once he's written about this and spoken about it many times, on a plane with Idi Amin, just the two of them, gun on the table, and he had a moral quandary of whether to shoot a man he knew was an evil dictator. Had you been in his position, would you have shot Idi Amin? If your answer is yes, do you wish you'd carried a gun when you met?
Did everyone hear that question?
No.
Can you repeat the question, Peter?
Sorry, Idi Amin was on a plane, but John Snow was on a plane with Idi Amin. And he was...
Do you want to take the microphone, sir?
You'll have to switch that one off. Or Peter, you repeat it.
It's better if you speak.
No, just
take this one out. Give this one.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
John Snow, the Channel 4 newsreader, has...
Oh, sorry. I have to say it off, I guess.
...has written about and spoken about the fact that he was once on a plane with the evil Ugandan dictator Idi Amin, and there was just the two of them in the part of the plane, and there was a gun on the table. And I asked Peter, if he'd been in Jon Snow's position, would he have done what Jon Snow faced the moral quandary of, do I shoot this man when I have the opportunity to do so? Would you shoot him? And if the answer is yes, do you wish you'd carried a gun when you met Robert Mugabe?
Well, first of all, I think firing a gun inside a plane would be very unwise. But that's not my cop-out answer. I am, by instinct, a pacifist and non-violent, and all my human rights activism is based upon the Gandhian Martin Luther King principles of non-violence. But I do think there may be extreme circumstances where violence is the lesser evil. And to be honest, let's say it wasn't a plane but in a room, I don't know that I would have had the courage, to be honest. You know, I would be very, very torn, morally and just in terms of just the sheer guts it would take to do that. I was once asked, to give a different, slightly different scenario, I was once asked in an interview with the New Statesman, if you could go back in time, where would you go to, or when would you go to, and what would you do? And I said, the 20th of January, 1933. on that night, Adolf Hitler went with one guard to Ribbentrop's house for dinner. And he walked through a dark garden, up a long path. He could have easily been assassinated. I think, obviously with hindsight, knowing what happened subsequently, if I had been there, I probably would have had at least the desire, if not the courage, to kill Hitler. And that, of course, would have prevented him from becoming Chancellor 10 days later, and that may well have changed the course of German history and perhaps resulted not in the Second World War and not in the Holocaust. So it's a really difficult moral dilemma. But I'm not an absolutist, non-violent person. I think there are certain extreme circumstances where perhaps violence is the lesser of two evils.
Thank you. Could I just say that I think as far as possible, at least the way things are at the moment, we want to emphasise the fact that we wish to carry out all our actions and do all our things within the law, within a legal framework, and if we think the law is unjust, to try by legal and democratic means to try to change the law. That's all. That's my contribution.
I would disagree. I think there are circumstances and occasions when it is morally right to break the law. Okay. I certainly think, you know, for people living under tyrannical regimes, often they have...
That's another matter. I mean, in this country.
Yeah, okay, fine. At the back.
You need to turn the microphone up.
Sorry for this time.
Now more on my... You mentioned Tony Blair, and you also mentioned a couple of court cases that you've been to, and the reluctance that the magistrates seem to offer to generate a precedent. So given that there's probably no chance that you're going to be able to get hold of somebody like Tony Blair to try and arrest him, try him for war crimes, what about one of his subordinates? Because there must be somebody out there that you can get hold of just to generate a precedent. And if we did that, would that not at least make Britain not a safe place for tyrants to visit?
Can I ask you, who are you thinking of? Who are you thinking of?
I was the King of Bahrain, who came to the Queen's birthday party with someone, or a bit more random. But, you know, we don't really seem to be that bothered about who we invite to the UK as a guest of state, and then find out that in the media that they've been abused in their own populations.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was quite shocked that the Queen personally invited seven royal dictators to celebrate her Diamond Jubilee at Windsor Castle. Dictators who had been involved in really gross human rights abuses. And we are very selective as a country about which human rights abuses we condemn. You know, there's this huge outcry, quite rightly, against President Assad of Syria, yet Britain is hand in glove with the Bahraini regime and their neighbours in Saudi Arabia, who commit terrible crimes. So there's a great deal of double standards, and I think it's a bit of consistency by Western countries like Britain would not go amiss. You know, to be taken credibly, we have to be consistent.
Presumably there's a pool of lawyers who are supportive for all you've been talking about. Could you say something about sort of what they're about, what they're up to, and have they got different scenarios that they would like to see implemented?
I mean, there's no group of lawyers who are specifically working on these issues, but there are some individual lawyers who, thanks to personal connections or campaigners, are working on particular individuals. So, for example, there is a group of lawyers who are trying to get a senior Israeli military figure arrested and put on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And they have, on a number of occasions, applied to courts. But at the end of the day, the individual in question has suddenly cancelled his plans to come to Britain. But you would think that of all the human rights lawyers there are, there ought to be almost like a full-time team working on these cases and in a very consistent and methodical way, because that would, by their own individual efforts or collective efforts as a group, send a very strong signal. If governments aren't prepared to act, then if we had a body of human rights lawyers who were dedicated to this task, it would, I think, really put the frighteners on a lot of, would-be people who might face prosecution.
They would need to be paid by someone.
Well, this is true, but many of these lawyers already do pro bono work. They do paid work, but then they do a small amount of pro bono work. If they collectively pooled all this pro bono work together as part of a team, I think it could be highly effective. And perhaps this is an idea for a new body of lawyers, lawyers for human rights or something, dedicated specifically to this purpose. No.
The people have lost confidence in the UN in terms of righting the wrongs of human rights violation. For example, in Sri Lanka, they commissioned an investigation, UN did, and the report and the investigation was conducted by eminent international persons, independent-minded, and they concluded that massive human rights violation took place at the end of the war, end of the internal rife between the government and the LTTE, and vast majority of innocent people were slaughtered. And indeed, Jon Snow pioneered one of the television programs. Now, since then, the report recommended, as you know, Peter, that there should be war crimes initiated against the president of Sri Lanka and some of those who were responsible for those actions. But as you rightly said, President of Sri Lanka was one of the visitors for the Queen's Golden Jubilee celebration, and I understand he was here for the Olympics too. So it is double standards. But can I ask a question about the legal framework that you seem to be dependent on in terms of highlighting these atrocities? Canada recently had a case whereby a naval officer who implemented some of the instructions from the president and his hierarchy was found guilty in Canadian courts when he applied for immigration, and his application was rejected on the basis that he collaborated with war crimes during his period as a naval officer in Sri Lanka. So there are individual cases developing all over the country, but certainly not against heads of states. They seem to have total immunity. Indeed, there was also citizens' arrest tried to be made in America and in London against President Rajapaksa, but it didn't materialize.
I think you're... I think you're right. International human rights law and its enforcement is evolving all the time, and it's often down to particular cases championed by particular campaign groups and lawyers, and these are gradually, slowly establishing more and more precedents. So the momentum is going in the right direction. It's still very depressing, as you say, that heads of state and other high officials are deemed to be exempt. But gradually, slowly, we are seeing more and more individual cases like the Canadian one you mentioned winning. And I think, you know, just our capacity and our focus must be to try and help move further in that direction and get the British government, because after all we are here in Britain, get the British government and the European Union to start making a much higher profile case to bring these torturers and tyrants to justice.
Just take two or three very more succinct questions, please.
Your talk and your answers have all been very much focused on a criminal model of retribution. How do you feel about South Africa's answer to a divided society where there was quite a lot of high-level complicity in acts of torture under apartheid, i.e. truth and reconciliation as an alternative model?
I think it's very hard when someone you know has suffered torture or perhaps even been disappeared or executed. It's very, very hard to think that that person has died or suffered terribly without the perpetrator being brought to justice. That's hard. Now, I'm a person who's a great believer in forgiveness and reconciliation, but I find that hard, and it must be very, very hard for people in South Africa. But of course, there is a broad consensus that that has been the way to deal with the past. And ultimately, that's got to be a decision of the South African people, that they must be the ones who decide. But I know that there are some South Africans who feel very, very unhappy that people in the apartheid regime who were personally responsible for really grotesque human rights abuses, effectively by confessing and asking for forgiveness, got away with it. The last one.
You mentioned that Well, the people who've been taken to the International Criminal Court were, you know, for example, Serbians or, for example, the Nuremberg trials. Is it a case of racism or some sort of perception why we are more willing to accept sort of crimes committed by leaders of, you know, from Africa or Asia? Or is it just, are we dismissive because it's not happening in our own backyard?
I think there is a sense, as in the case with Henry Kissinger, that the really big, powerful people are too big to tackle. I don't think they are. I think every human rights abuser is equally responsible and equally liable for what they've done. But in terms of international law and enforcement, you're right. Obviously, it is the smaller fish, the Milosevic's and the Taylors, who've been taken to The Hague, not the Henry Kissingers, George Bushes, or Tony Blairs. And that double standards does rankle, because international human rights law should apply to everyone without discrimination. If you abuse human rights, you ought to be held responsible, no matter how big and powerful you are, no matter how big and powerful your nation is or your government is. You should be held responsible. And, you know, it's again, so often the case that governments seem to shy away from bringing powerful people to book. They think it's just too big an issue, too big a thing to take on. And we need to get away from that mentality.
Can I just ask you one question as well? Your view on Putin? Can I just
sneak in with a very last question? And the view on Putin and the female sort of punk band making their protest in a church about him, and what you feel about that?
Well, of course, I have some form on this area. In 1998, myself and six other members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender human rights group Outrage walked into the pulpit of the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. George Carey, and criticised his support for legal discrimination against gay people. He was saying that gay people are inferior and therefore not entitled to equal human rights. And he was endorsing discrimination in employment, partnership recognition, fostering and adoption of children, and so on. We did not abuse the Christian religion or the Archbishop himself. We simply made the case for human rights. So by comparison to Pussy Riot, we were quite tame. We were tame pussies. But I think you probably all know that as a consequence, I was charged and eventually convicted under the 1860 Ecclesiastical Courts Jurisdiction Act, formerly part of the Brawling Act of 1551. Under that law, any kind of protest in a church, no matter how peaceful and brief, is a criminal offence. I could have been fined, I think, £5,000 and sent to jail for 6 months, but having heard the evidence, the magistrate decided this was not a major, major crime, and I was fined the sum of £18.60. The magistrate's comical allusion to the 1860 Act under which I'd been convicted. I wear it as a badge of pride. It's the only standing conviction I have in 45 years and over 3,000 direct action and civil disobedience protests. But I can tell you, it beats behaviour like a cause a breach of the peace or obstructing the highway. It's a better class of conviction, I think. But going back to Pussy Riot, I think their prosecution is emblematic of the much wider, deeper and longer repression that's been happening in Russia under Putin. Effectively, slowly, ratchet by ratchet, Putin is taking Russia back to the Soviet-style era, where all dissent is heavily repressed. As you know, many, many, many campaigners on a range of issues, from the rights of pensioners who've had their pensions slashed, to trade unionists, ethnic minorities, environmental campaigners, have all been subjected to similar state repression, using the law to suppress them and crush their dissent, sometimes using the Nashi or other pro-Putin thugs and gangs to beat people up. I mean, in 2007, when I was badly beaten up by neo-Nazis in Moscow, only a short time later, some of the same gangs that beat me up were responsible for attacking an environmental peace camp where they actually killed one of the protesters and put 15 others in hospital with critical injuries. So, you know, what's happening in Russia is very scary and very shocking, and I'm sure you all know about the large number of journalists and lawyers who've been beaten, in some cases killed, and rarely, if ever, have their perpetrators ever been brought to justice. So to me, it's the Pussy Riot case is emblematic of that wide repression, and I think by doing their protest and conducting the trial in the imaginative way they have, they really have captured the imagination of people around the world, including some people in Russia. As you know, Russia is very split. There's a lot of hardliners who think that Pussy Riot should not only get what they deserve, but, you know, many more years in prison, and even some people say they should be executed. But you know, there are others in Russia who do want to see a free nation where human rights and democracy are respected. And I think Pussy Riot have been fantastic in helping to highlight that, as well as, you know, specific issues around women's rights and the rights of LGBT people and others. And they've been really, really clever in the way in which they've sought to embrace the whole human rights agenda and the whole democracy agenda. And there, of course, have been many other protests by democracy campaigners. None of them have got the press attention the Pussy Riot have. And of course, with any protest, you need to get press attention to raise public awareness. And I think Pussy Riot have done more than anybody else to highlight the repression in Putin's Russia. And for that, they've done a great service to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things. Essentially, if you like the sorts of things that Peter Tatchell talks about, you'll like our show too. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.